Partly sunny skies at 71 degrees. Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott, and we begin with the latest on Georgia's recovery from hurricane and tropical storm Irma. Now, Georgia Governor Nathan Deal will tour those areas impacted by Irma tomorrow. That will include an aerial survey of damages in north and coastal Georgia. And meanwhile, restoring power is still ongoing around the Atlanta area and other parts of the state. You'll likely see crews working to get power restored. For the latest, I'm joined on the line with Georgia Power spokesperson John Kraft. John, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having us on.
Let's get an update. Approximately how many households and businesses are still without power as of right now?
Well, across the state, as of midday today on Wednesday, we have about 332,000. That number continues to change. We've actually seen a few new outages today from some wind that may have brought down some hanging limbs and things like that, but we continue to make progress and work that number down.
Looking at the Georgia Power outage map earlier, the Atlanta area, Brunswick, and Savannah, those are the areas crews seem to be really working hard to get power restored. Is that correct?
Well, those areas, along with all across the state, that was one thing that made this storm so unique, is that it was from one end of the state to the other. So Metro Atlanta, Savannah, in most every county in between.
Let's focus on Savannah for a moment, John, because flooding and obviously down power lines have to be a challenge for your crews.
That is definitely the case. Flooded roads and areas make it difficult for the crews to get to. And if there's underground service, flooded areas are some of the last to be restored.
Moving to our WABE listening area, several neighborhoods are still without power. It may seem like a silly question, but any idea how long it could take before everyone in this region, in the Atlanta area, will be restored with their power?
Right. That is a figure, an estimate. We know everyone is very interested in hearing. We continue to try to refine the assessments that we've made since the storm cleared so that we can give a good idea on when we'll have most people back. We don't want to give out premature information or bad information, so we've been careful to say this will definitely be a multi-day process, even though we continue to make good progress every day.
And no doubt it is frustrating for those still without power. John, what can you advise during this time?
Well, we do appreciate their patience. We know how inconvenient it is. A number of the members on our team here in the Georgia Power Storm Center and throughout the state have lost power at their own homes. So we certainly understand firsthand in many cases how inconvenient it is and are working hard to restore power. Appreciate their patience. They can continue to – they really don't need to call in their outage. Mm-hmm. Right now, we're pretty aware on this scale. If they want to, that's certainly fine, or log it into our online system. On GeorgiaPower.com, and we just appreciate their patience and ask them to be very careful with all the wire that is still down around the state.
Georgia Power spokesperson John Kraft, thanks for taking the time and thanks for the update. I really appreciate it.
Glad to do it. Thank you.
You know, as mentioned, there are several areas still without power. WABE's Tasneem Shama has been out in some of those neighborhoods. She joins me now on the line from Kirkwood. Tasneem, thanks for taking the time.
Yep, of course.
Where have you been and who have you talked to?
So I'm in the Kirkwood neighborhood on Hosea Williams Drive. It's close to the East Lake MARTA station.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked to a lot of people. There's Jeffrey Welch and Michelle Welch. So Harrison and Welch.
And Tasneem, surely there's a lot of frustration for those residents or businesses as well still without power in that area. Did we lose Tasneem Shama? Oh, maybe we did.
Yep.
Tasneem, are you with me? Well, from power outages to cell phone outages, as you know, also schools have been closed today. Clayton, DeKalb, Gwinnett, they're all closed today, as well as the Atlanta Public Schools. And this is where we check in with APS Superintendent Dr. Maria Karstarfin, who hopefully joins me on the line. Dr. Karstarfin, thanks for taking the time.
I would never miss it. Thank you. I'm glad to be on the show.
Let's begin with an assessment check. How many, if any, are there currently APS schools with any infrastructure damage?
Well, we don't have much in infrastructure damage. Some small flooding, some branches that, you know, complicated some sites, debris to clean up. But most of our challenges have been around power.
And so currently, how many schools remain without power?
Yeah, we're now at 6 neighborhood schools and 1 charter school. And you know, it's been kind of intermittent here and there, but pretty much Georgia Power has been a rock star. I was so glad their attention to Atlanta Public Schools and the surrounding school districts has been extraordinary.
Now, how big of a challenge would it have been to resume classes for those schools with power, and then for those without, you know, you slowly would bring them back online?
Yeah, it was the challenge was where the power outages kind of ended up being geographically located. They ended up being all over the district. I didn't have an area like South Atlanta or the Mays cluster. Mm-hmm. You know, you didn't have a concentrated spot. So it was from north to south and east to west, and that made it very difficult to kind of target a particular area to shut down portions of the school district. But we started with 35 schools. That's a large part of our portfolio, and being down to 6 today makes things I feel a lot more hopeful about opening school tomorrow.
And all extracurricular APS events, including sporting events and those big games, they're also on hold until the district officially reopens, correct?
Yeah, Rose, and most of it is because of the other dangers. You heard Georgia Power talk about, you know, the down lines. Some of our areas, especially in around South Atlanta, Farrell, Heritage Academy, Brandon Elementary School, still have significant tree damage, and they're trying to get the electrical back up. And that means that plus wet sidewalks could end up, you know, being an electrical safety issue for kids. So walking on those sidewalks, the roadways were still pretty dangerous. So we did not bring our kids back. We wanted to be sure that we did a double check before anybody was out there in those wet fields around areas where we were still having challenges.
You know, often makeup days for winter weather is built into the school calendar. APS will now need to make up these 3 days, and winter hasn't even arrived yet.
Well, actually, you know, we have the new contract with the state. We are a charter system operating model, so they give us flexibility in our school calendar. We do start school a little early, and we build in some days for flexibility. So we sit at about 180 days, and that makes it possible for us to have a couple of days where when weather gets difficult, we have some flexibility. You're right, though. Winter and ice hasn't hit yet. So that still has me on pins and needles. But for now, we still look okay, and we think we can make up some of our instructional time by doing some creative work within the schools for now.
And as for tomorrow, when should parents expect notification from APS about classes resuming?
Well, you should always assume school is open unless I tell you it's not.
Spoken so, like a true educator.
Yeah, so come to school, plan, start getting yourselves organized. The big challenge, though, is we have a lot of staff who live outside the immediate Atlanta metro area, meaning the city of Atlanta. And so I'm looking at DeKalb schools right now. You know, they still have a lot of schools without power. We're really dependent on the surrounding area to be strong so that we can have our staff come in. But you know me, I'm incredibly thorough. So we call every single staff member to check on them to find out how they're doing, how their family is doing, what their electrical situation is. And we look a lot better today than we did yesterday, where we thought we would have several hundreds of folks out in a staff of about 6,000. So today it looks more possible. And I think our human resource department is doing a great job with our ops team getting a confirmation on who can come. Do we have enough coverage to run our school routes, our cafeterias, a lot of the support services, but also having teachers in classrooms. So APS is looking good.
My producer told me you were out helping to clear debris as well. You're out there
sure
with a chainsaw?
Hey, look, I have a truck. I'm pretty hardcore. I wish I had a chainsaw. They wouldn't let me have one yesterday, but I know my way around a chainsaw. But I left it to the experts. But where possible, yeah, I'm so thankful to a couple of my board members, Nancy Meister, Jason Esteves, Ishe Collins, who are out there with me, kind of driving around, helping me get a good assessment to give feedback from the field. We put all hands on deck. Daniel Gordon, the COO for the city, was a great partner. And, of course, our entire senior leadership team, they all went out in the field trying to get real qualitative data to give us good feedback to complement the quantitative collection we were doing. I think we made some smart decisions yesterday and the day before. I wish we were in school today, but I think it's, safety first. And I think that we'll be stronger tomorrow for having made those decisions in the way that we did over the last 72 hours.
All right. Atlanta Public Schools Superintendent Chainsaw Dr. Maria Karstarfin. Thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
It's always fun. Y'all have a good day.
You too. And a note of disclosure, WAB's broadcast license is held by the Atlanta Board of Education. Coming up next, a conversation with Emory President Dr. Claire Sterk. This is Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from WellStar Kennestone Hospital, which received Gold Seal Distinction for heart valve, coronary artery bypass surgery, and congestive heart failure. Kennestone is one of only two programs in the country to receive this distinction. WellStar.org. And from Aurora Theater, presenting Throw Me on the Burn Pile and Light Me Up, a play rooted in Southern storytelling by Lucy Alibar, the Oscar-nominated writer of Beast of the Southern Wild. Now through October 1st, AuroraTheater.com.
You're listening to Closer Look. If you missed any of today's conversation, catch up on our website at wabe.org/closerlook. Again, wabe.org/closerlook. Also, we want to hear from you. Send our host, Rose Scott, an email, rose@wabe.org. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the risk of nuclear war with North Korea. We talk with New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos, who spent 4 days in Pyongyang last month, where he says talk of nuclear war is everywhere, including on TV and billboards. We'll talk about why this has become an especially risky time and where it might lead. Join us this afternoon at 2 on 90.1 WABE.
And you're tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. Just a little bit more than a year ago, in fact, September 1st to be exact, Dr. Claire Sterk officially began serving as Emory University's 20th president. And some history for you. Dr. Sterk is Emory's first female president. Now, previously, she served as the provost and executive vice president for academic affairs. Last year, in her very first interview as then president-elect Sterk, she spoke to Closer Look, and we vowed to meet again a year later. And that's where we met, for another one-on-one on the campus of Emory University. Now, a programming note, you'll hear references to the future of the DACA program. This interview with President Sterk took place before the announcement was made to rescind DACA.
Madam President, thank you so much for being so gracious with your time. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you coming back as we had a date.
Can you summarize into one sentence what the first year has been like for you?
It's been amazing. We have been bold, and we are doing it in a world that is quite chaotic right now.
You mentioned quite chaotic. As the school year gets underway, there's a lot happening in terms of conversations about free speech, open expression. We think about what's happened in Charlottesville, Virginia. You are the president of a university. When you saw all that taking place, what went through your mind in terms of how would you handle a situation like that if it happened here?
So I'm going to take the privilege of first starting out with me as a person and then moving on to me as the president of what I believe is fantastic and very mature university when it comes to these issues. One of the observations is then when there is such pain and hurt, let me just start again. When there is such pain and hurt in the world, then it seems that there are always people who step up to the plate. And so despite all the sadness and even the anger, it's so reaffirming to see people who just rise to the top and who make sure that we stick with our values And what is special now as I shift to being the president at Emory is that I'm very proud of the values we have in this community, which are really focused on inclusivity, mutual respect, but also really being open to healthy debate. One aspect that I've come to appreciate much more about Emory this past year, I knew about it, but now I have a deeper level of appreciation, is the extent to which this community, and I mean every member of the community, is willing and able to engage in difficult conversations for constructive outcomes.
During your inaugural address, you said, and I'm quoting you here, at today's inauguration, we renew our commitment to Emory's reason for being. What do you mean by that?
I can tell you what I mean by it now and what I mean by it then. It's a real privilege to be a leader and to be part of a community like Emory. And I don't mean this as a cliche, but with that privilege also comes tremendous responsibility. We need to take that responsibility. We have a responsibility because of what we do at the core of our mission as a university, despite the research, the healthcare, and everything else that we are engaged in, is training the next generation of leaders. And that's our students.
As you talk about the next generation of leaders being your current students, but in your inaugural address, you also talked about recognizing the past, and you looked at the history of this institution as it relates to race relations, as it related to the admission of its first African-American students. And I've been asking this question a lot to a lot of guests on Closer Look. After the election of President Obama, there was all this conversation about, are we in a post-racial America? But then given what's been taking place over the last month or so, what are your thoughts in terms of where this nation is in terms of its race relations? And then I'll ask you to follow up in terms of what role can an institution like Emory play in that conversation?
Looking at what has been happening over the past few months, I think it's telling all of us that as we, looking at the situation over the past several months, I believe tells all of us that we were hopeful, that we were on the right path when it comes to healing race relations in this country. I think it's more than race relations in many ways, because we also know that race and class are quite intersected and opportunities are part of that equation, and that we need to accept the fact that despite all that hope and all that optimism, we're not all there yet. And I think that's what a big part of the shock is, in addition to everything I already mentioned, is to realize that we are not where we thought we would be. So then when you talk about that in the context of the responsibility of a place like Emory, we have spent this past year a lot of very positive energy on having open dialogues. We have a commission on social and racial justice that actually is led by the students. Mm-hmm. It came out of the Black student demands. We didn't let it slip as things quieted down. We kept the conversations going. That means that as an institution, we are at a reasonable good place of not only having intellectual conversations about race relations, but also being very intentional. What can we contribute to coming up with real solutions to this? That's true not just for the students, it's also the faculty and the staff. Where we are becoming much more proactive than we have been is how can we then spread that wisdom.
My apologies on that. See, I'm the main person.
When you then think about the responsibility of Emory beyond its own campus, which is clearly, as you know, something that's a priority for us, we need to be very intent, and we are, and how can we spread that wisdom to the rest of the world? You heard me last year when I talked about my own work that I've done in Atlanta, the neighborhoods that nobody wanted to go to, that now are still in difficult situations for different reasons. So I believe I have a level of empathy that's driven by reality and not just ideology. We have many people on the Emory campus who are in that place, and we are working on this at every level. I'm not saying we have the solutions yet, but we're very committed to contributing to the solutions. There's not going to be a big fix for this. So if I can give one example, actually, let me not go there because I'll just go on too long.
You sure?
Yeah.
Moving from being a part of the national dialogue to regional issues, regional concerns, but national policies could affect, could impact what this university does, like a lot of other institutions across the country. For example, immigration and the travel ban and those type of policies. Are you one of those presidents that tries to either stay in the middle and not lean one way or the other? But if you know those particular policies and legislation could affect an institution, primarily yours, how do you approach giving your input?
My approach is to be very proactive, to not only engage with our policymakers at times of crisis, but have conversations throughout so that you have a foundation, at least upon which to interact, that's not always driven by a moment of dissatisfaction. And I believe that serves us really well. One aspect that I've learned in my role as president is that people who are proactive have multiple paths, but if I can make it a dichotomy for a second, you can be publicly proactive or you can be quietly proactive. Mm-hmm. I have learned about myself that I believe in doing a lot of work behind the scene so that you can actually have constructive conversations without having a whole public large audience be part of that. But at the same time, then wanting to share that with our community. So since you mentioned immigration, we don't know what's going to happen later this week. The world is confused, at least we in the United States are confused, for example, of what's going to happen with the DACA program. That impacts a significant number of our students. We are in touch with those students. They are very anxious. We want to recognize that and start preparing for what could happen so that we don't have to do this at the last minute. I've written letters to our Georgia legislators to encourage them to speak up and do what they can do to not make this happen. I have been part of leadership groups in higher education, and sometimes that just has included signing on to a letter from a collective, but also as Emory's president individually really reached out to people and explained why I believe that this is a decision that will have unanticipated negative consequences that not everybody has thought through or even would be aware of.
The university obviously looks for your leadership on something like that, quite different from when you were just, not just a researcher, but when you were doing research and when you were provost. And has that been the biggest learning curve for you, Madam President? Because you are the leader of this institution, and so you take, they follow your lead. I know you work with the board and you know, you work with the faculty senate and sometimes. So how has that been in terms of this transition?
So I actually don't think it's been that big a transition.
Really?
Because I always have felt that it's my responsibilities, given the privileged positions I have been in. And this is just another privileged position in my life. I'm not using that to put it down. I'm very excited about it. To really focus on ways in which we can not only empower people whose existence is being threatened, whose lives are being demolished in some ways, but to go beyond empowerment and provide a voice by either providing opportunities for them to have a voice and be part of a voice to speak up for them in very respectful ways. And I hate to continually go back to my research career, but I think that actually was the best preparation for this job. I didn't know that. That's another lesson I've learned this year, that the work I did in Atlanta 20 years ago and did until fairly recently and do some of it still, has been an incredible preparation for the kind of leadership that we need in the president of a university at this point in time.
You have been focusing on, within this year, the impact of this institution, not just to the surrounding community, not just to Atlanta, but to the state. And when I read that Emory has a $9.1 billion impact into the economy of this state, you see something like that. The question is, how do you improve upon that? What areas are still left that need to be enhanced, or what areas are still challenging for this university in terms of the impact of the region and the state?
So it's interesting that I'm very proud, by the way, of the impact report, because it tells part of what Emory does within the city, the region, the state, the county, that many people are not aware of. And I would say that's true many people on the outside and many people even within the Emory community who would like be very proud of this. Like, I had no idea that we did all this. What has been interesting to me, and maybe it's because I'm a social scientist, is that I've gotten more comments on the economic impact chapter in the report that we have than the community and social impact.
Well, people like numbers, and when they hear 9.1 billion,
that's correct. So I want to be the storyteller and bring people back to those other stories.
So now you can tell them.
And I think that what we do in terms of charitable care, the contributions that we make to Grady, and part of me, by the way, Rose, feels good that people don't talk about that, because it's sort of Emory's style to do that because it's the right thing to do and not to get a headline. The work that we do with social entrepreneurship throughout the state, the work with farm workers in the southern part of the state. I mean, I can go on and on.
Let's talk about some of your priorities. I know it's just been year one, but within this year, were there any initiatives that you were able to either start the conversation rolling in terms of implementation? And I guess maybe a better question is, how did you prioritize what those initiatives and those concerns, what your top concerns were going to be?
So we're in the middle of finalizing, actually close to the end of finalizing, Emory's official strategic plan. Mm-hmm. We will have our final round of community input, and not so much adding to the criteria, but really deciding what do we mean by this, how do we want to prioritize. That will be done this fall, and then my hope is, and I think it's realistic, that the board will approve our official plan in early 2018. I can tell you obviously a little bit of what's in there. A lot of it has to do with academic excellence, but it's academic excellence for impact. It's the research we do, it's the scholarship that takes place, it's the collaborative, interdisciplinary nature. Another one that I believe I had on the list last June, certainly had it last September, mm-hmm. is to focus on an Emory student experience. And particularly right now, this past year, have made tremendous progress. We've made tremendous progress in enhancing and creating, making stronger a Emory undergraduate experience. Mm-hmm. We are a university that has 9 schools and colleges. It's like so many complex organizations, they turn into silos and people do not have access to everything that the organization has to offer. We've broken down those walls and are having now an undergraduate experience where students can take advantage of everything that Emory has to offer. And that includes academically as well as their personal growth, because we're not just in training people in figuring out what they're going to do, mm-hmm. but more importantly, what they're going to be.
Moving from the students to the faculty and staff, and I've covered this institution when there were concerns about departments being merged or departments simply going away. Have you had time to create a strategy or approach for dealing with faculty concerns and challenges and things that are important to them? And it's just been a year, so.
That's okay. Thank you for giving me that cop-out, but I'm not going to take it for this one yet. Fortunately, I was a faculty member, and that's fortunately probably in quotation marks, during the times of the restructuring that took place. I believe you're referring to Emory College of Arts and Sciences. Mm-hmm. And we have come a long way since then. As you know, it has not been an easy process. It was very disruptive and painful at the time. But here is how something good can come out of something bad or stressful. Because I've spent a lot of time talking with faculty, not each and every faculty mm-hmm. member, but I love leaving my office, just walking across campus, walking in and ask people, what are you doing? What's on your mind? And what I've learned is that what has come out of that is a strong understanding among the faculty how, even if we think about schools and departments and centers and institute, what's amazing is the faculty that want to work together, and the faculty that have found ways to work together. Mm-hmm. So just like I referenced, that we are making the student experience such that people can take advantage of everything NOES. We're doing the same for the faculty, so we have many more opportunities for faculty to teach across, which actually is what hurt people the most. It wasn't necessarily that a department went away, but what does it mean for my role at this university? And I feel we're not only at a very good place, we're at a leading place in terms of what that allows our faculty to do.
But what did you learn from that era when the restructuring was happening? And quite frankly, you had colleagues who were unhappy, who were vocal about that.
My job is not to judge the past, but I will tell you how I function mm-hmm. and how I believe we can prevent something like that happening moving forward. And it really boils down to communication, having a shared understanding, having people understand what is it really that I'm upset about, and that's in some ways what happened, right?
Was transparency an issue as well, you think?
Some people would say it was, and I've also heard from people who said transparency was not an issue. And that's, I think, the nature of a large organization, that there are always people that feel they know, people that feel they don't know, people who know but didn't think it was true and never really took it in. It's hard to disentangle that, but I do know that, which I think is the message I want you to hear, was that as an institution, we have grown from that, and now we're doing things that don't exist at many other places in terms of the ability of faculty to work together.
Speaking of restructuring, Emory also had to restructure, if not its approach to dealing with campus sexual assault allegations. Have you had a chance to look at the university's policies and procedures for dealing with allegations? First question.
Yes, very much so.
And are you in favor, or do you have any issues with the policies and procedures as it relates to dealing with allegations?
If I can give you a little bit more background on that, and I'll try to keep it succinct. It's amazing, and I mentioned earlier to you how my earlier research career prepared me well for this job. I've done a lot of work with men and women who were victims of sexual assault, and that has given me a broad interest, so it's not a new topic for mm-hmm. me to deal with. Right now in my current role, you have to navigate the legal requirements, the cultural context, and making sure that those are not in conflict with each other. I feel that we are at a place where I'm comfortable to say they're not in conflict with each other, and that we have processes in place to make sure that we do what we want to do within our culture, but also legally.
Does the campus first investigate the allegation, or do you call outside authorities to come?
Our current procedures are that the campus first does the investigation.
As we wrap up, here's a word for you, annexation. Some other words for you, City of Atlanta, and then Emory University. Are you all trying to stay out of that political back and forth? You have submitted your opinion on it, but just for the record, again, are you fine with Emory being annexed into the City of Atlanta?
I'm not just fine with it. I think it's in the best interest of Emory, and it's the best interest of the region. I have had the opportunity, we did file our petition earlier this summer. I have had the opportunity before and after to meet with the leadership in DeKalb County. I have met with the leadership in the city. I've talked with our partners who also have filed separate petitions, Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, the CDC. And I remain convinced that it's in the best interest. I also have been very clear every opportunity I have to tell people in DeKalb County who feel that Emory is letting them down. Mm-hmm. I've looked at them and said, well, can't you be proud that you have Emory in your county? We will always be part of DeKalb County. We mm-hmm. will continue to invest in DeKalb County. So we have Executive Park, where we have great work taking place, ranging from Emory continuing education to brain health to the Hawks and sports medicine. Mm-hmm. We have in South DeKalb, Stonecrest, the medical facility. We're not leaving DeKalb County, we're staying in DeKalb County. And there's nothing we can do to have the city and the county work together And I'm very eager, needless to say, to see what will come out of the panel that's going to look at this. But my personal opinion is that it serves Emory well to annex into the city of Atlanta, and it's not going to take away from DeKalb County.
When we started this interview, I asked you to, if you could summarize into a sentence or a word what that first year was like. So now as you move into your second year, can you summarize what you hope comes out of it for you personally?
For me personally, I'd like the outcome to be that we will continue to have the difficult conversations that we need to have, that we will continue to do so with mutual respect and civility, that we will not lose the emphasis on the contributions we must make outside of Emory, because once there's a lot of tension and concern within the community, it's so easy to become inward looking. We will do that, but I want us to also stay outward looking. And I'm very proud. I think I now feel much more comfortable than I did a year ago to really become Emory's storyteller.
Claire Sturck, Emory University president. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Support for WABE comes from Reliable Heating and Air, a Trane dealer, a family company since 1978, offering heating and air, plumbing, electrical, and duct cleaning 24 hours a day. Learn more at reliableair.com. And from California Closets, committed to designing solutions for organizing any room in the home. Inspiration available at all four California Closets showrooms, Alpharetta, Buckhead, Lawrenceville, and now in East Cobb. Online at californiaclosets.com.
My name is Ann Nguyen, and I live in Stone Mountain. I like the shops. I like artists from there. I like the attractions and Stone Mountain Park. They have activities for kids. You know, they can practice and familiarize themselves with art, like pottery, painting. If I could change one thing about Stone Mountain, it would be traffic jam. It's really bad there.
Support for WABE comes from the Zuckerman Museum of Art, presenting the exhibition Medium. Everyone has a ghost story. What's yours? Reception September 16th. You can learn more at zuckerman.kennesaw.edu.
It's easy to look at the headlines to get a sense of the news.
Nine senators rejected that Senate version of the bill.
Venezuela was paralyzed by strikes and protests.
This missile can actually travel much farther than...
All Things Considered digs into the center of the story to help you really understand not just what's happening, but why. Stand with the facts. Listen every day. From 4 to 6:30, it's All Things Considered here on 90.1 WABE.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, for some should be a legal path to citizenship. And others, they say it's an unlawful immigration policy. Of course, it was established by the Obama administration in 2012, and it was for children brought to this country, some say illegally, with their parents. Now, the program was temporary so that Congress could pass a more, quote, comprehensive reform bill for undocumented children here in the U.S. Now, according to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, right here in Georgia, more than 24,000 people have been approved through the DACA program. And recently on this program, immigration attorney Charles Cook talked about what the current decision could mean for Georgia students with DACA protection.
In Georgia, most of them have lawyers. Most of them know that they have somebody there to fight for them. But most of them also know that at the end of the day, if they get put into deportation proceedings, they likely have no relief from deportation.
Now, often, those with DACA status are referred to as dreamers. Well, today, I'm joined in studio with four dreamers, Sumbo Siddiqui, Raymond Portolan, Marisol Estrada, and Alondra Venezuela. Welcome to you all. Thanks for coming in and taking the time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll start with you, Raymond. At what age did you come to the U.S.?
I came here to the United States from the Philippines when I was 1 year old.
My name is Marisol. Mm-hmm. I came to the U.S. when I was 4 years old. I came from Mexico.
Simple.
I came to the U.S. when I was 4 years old, and my parents originally came from Pakistan.
Hi, Alondra.
I came to the U.S. as well when I was 2 years old from Mexico.
Where do you all have conversations with your family about this whole DACA policy and their concerns? And, you know, when you're out and about, are people asking you all, hey, what do you think is going to happen? What's that conversation like?
Well, for me, ever since Donald Trump was first elected president last November, there's always been this sense of uncertainty in all of our communities. I live in what's called a mixed status family, where my two parents are both undocumented. I am undocumented and a DACA recipient, and my two younger brothers are U.S. citizens. And so for a family like ours, for example, my middle brother is 4 years younger than me, but the fact that he's a U.S. citizen makes all the difference in the world. And so we do have conversations around this issue all the time. And it's really the most difficult conversation to have with your parents when you have to talk about what your preparedness plan is going to be if Donald Trump were to come after us.
Marisol, he talked about a preparedness plan. Have you had conversations like that with your family?
Yeah, of course. A family preparedness plan is something that all undocumented families should definitely talk about. After Trump was inaugurated, you know, our community was very scared because he ran on, you know, eliminating DACA. So we would always have that conversation with friends and with family, you know, what's going to happen if DACA ends? How are we going to react? And the family preparedness plan is definitely something everyone should have.
Simba, what about you, your family?
Well, my family is actually quite similar to Raymond's family, mm-hmm. and I have two younger siblings that are also U.S. citizens, and my other brother is also a DACA recipient like me. So I'm not too sure 100% what we would be doing exactly because our family might be separated, you know, and that's one of the major concerns that we have. And so just like Marisol was saying with the family preparedness plan, it's easy to talk about, but actually going through with it, you know, is probably the hardest thing.
Alondra, when you think about a plan like that, what goes through your mind?
A lot of things literally go through everyone's mind. My mom fears every time I go out the door. You know, is she going to come back? Is she going to be okay? And it's something that parents shouldn't have to worry about, you know. And we do have a preparedness plan as well, and I'm as well as Symbol and Raymond here. I do have a mixed family as well. My two younger siblings are born here. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I shouldn't have my 9-year-old sister tell me, you know, what's going to happen to you? You know, are they going to separate us? And it breaks everyone's heart, but we do have a preparedness plan, and we're just basically waiting to see what happens.
That term, undocumented, I've spoken to a lot of people. Some say, you know, that term makes me feel like I'm not wanted, makes me feel like I'm not a citizen of this country. What does that term mean to you? Marisol, I'll start with you.
So it's something that I think defines us in a way that is the most humane, because illegal is a term that a lot of people use, and you know, no human being is illegal. Illegal is a verb. And the term undocumented, I think, is what we call ourselves, because other people do call us dreamers. Some people don't like the term dreamer because, you know, we're not really living the dream, we're living nightmares. And not everyone agrees with the term. Undocumented is just a more humane term, in my perspective.
Do you like that term, dreamer? Because that's how I refer to you all.
Yeah, of course. I'm okay with dreamer. I think, you know, everyone's a dreamer. And whenever somebody calls me dreamer, I just think of the song. Mm-hmm. Who sings that song?
I think you're thinking about Imagine.
Yeah.
By John Lennon.
Yeah, that song. So that song comes to mind.
I was just listening to it the other day, thinking about that.
Yeah, but there are some people that don't agree with the term, mm-hmm. but me personally, I'm okay with it.
Simba, what about you?
Well, with the term dreamer, I'm personally okay with it too, because when I think of dreamer, I think of the average working American, mm-hmm. you know, where you're students, you're part of your community, and essentially our parents were the original dreamers. But I also agree with the term undocumented, because when you call us illegal, you know, it takes away our humanity. It would make me feel like I'm a bad person, and for a long time, before I found out that I was undocumented, or when I found out when I was undocumented, I felt like I was this bad person and I wasn't deserving of.
How old were you when you first heard that term, undocumented?
I believe my end of high school years.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Raymond, I mean, you talked about it, but Alondra, when you hear that term?
I mean, I'm also, as everyone else, I'm also okay with the word dreamers, because that's what we're here. We're here to accomplish our dreams. We're here to achieve something that we basically can't achieve in our country. And undocumented, it doesn't, I mean, I'm okay with that as well.
So for me, I understand why some people, especially within the undocumented community, push back mm-hmm. against the word dreamer when it's referred to people like us. And I think that's because sometimes when people use that particular word, they use it to create the sense of exceptionalism for people like us. Like we are special, that it propagates this narrative that we came here through no fault of our own, that we shouldn't have to pay for the sins, the crimes that our parents committed. But in reality, we have to remember that it's not only about us. It's not just about the 800,000 DACA recipients that are here in this country, but there are 11 million undocumented people who live in this country who came here in the search of better opportunity. And anyone can relate to that. And we can't demonize everyone else for our own benefit and our own sake.
Because of the DACA status, you all work. You can't drive legally. You pay taxes, but you can't vote. When this decision came down, were there concerns from your employers about the future of or your status of your job, Raymond?
Well, here in the state of Georgia, it's required. Most employers are required to verify your ability to work here legally in the United States, and so naturally, there is concern, especially when people start losing their work authorizations beginning March 5th, 2018. Forward.us, a national advocacy organization for undocumented immigrants, estimates that around 1,400 DACA recipients will lose their work authorization every single day after March 5th, 2018.
When you think about that, Raymond, you have a job.
It's hard to say when my work authorization expires in August of 2018.
So you have a few months.
So I have a couple of months, but I think it's important for people to realize that when the DACA program is swept from under us, it creates this great sense of uncertainty, like the safety and security that we've all enjoyed for the last 5 years of our lives goes away just like that.
Marisol, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, the reality is when you lose your work authorization, when that work authorization card expires, you do lose your job. You know, I have friends that even before the program was rescinded, she was a teacher and her work authorization expired because they were taking longer than normal to mm-hmm. do her renewal. And this is the case for a lot of people with DACA. Renewals are taking longer than usual. And so her work authorization expired. And she couldn't teach, so she had a substitute teacher in her class for 3 weeks because she wasn't able to be in her classroom because she wasn't authorized to teach. And so she lost her job, and she had to figure out a way to make ends meet. And so that's a reality that we're all going to be living, except in 2 or 3 weeks, we're not going to be able to get that work authorization back. So that's exactly why we're fighting now. We're organizing amongst ourselves, mm-hmm. calling on to our congressmen, senators, representatives to make sure that something in legislation gets passed to make something more permanent.
So, but let me ask you this. How optimistic are you that Congress can come up with some type of comprehensive reform plan?
I'm not too sure about Congress, but I am hopeful in the people. You know, I've never seen this much support from our allies for a long time. I felt very alone. And now that all these people are speaking out, from my teachers, from my coworkers, from people who don't know what it's like to be a dreamer, and they're speaking out for us. So I believe in the people.
Alondra, what about you?
Well, I mean, I guess I don't, I like symbol, I don't know. I don't know, because it's basically in their hands to make that decision. But since I feel like we're not going to be able to speak, but we have other people that are going to be able to speak for us. And, you know, we have all the support from state to state, support from family members, support from friends that we have. So it's, you know, it's good to have that support, because that's literally what we need right now, support from everyone.
How stressful is this for you all, not just even the not knowing and now, but throughout all of this? And Raymond, I want to start with you. How tough has this been for you?
Being undocumented has been single-handedly the greatest challenge that I've ever had to face in my entire life. And I became undocumented when I was 10. And just like so many other millions of undocumented people across the country, when you're that young and you realize that you're undocumented, you don't know what kind of effect it's going to have on your life. But then you get older, and Alondra and I had a conversation earlier about how everyone gets their driver's licenses and they get to take on their first jobs and think about college. But for people like us, we feel left behind. Like, we don't have access to the same kind of things and the same benefits that our peers have access to, even though we grew up right here in the same exact place as them.
We're running, I wish we had more time, we're running short on time, but I just want you all to think back to maybe 3 years ago and now. And do you have the same feeling that you had about living in the United States and what it means to live in this country and be a part of this nation?
Well, 3 years ago, it was when I first received my DACA. Mm-hmm. I was happy, you know, because it started to open up a little bit more doors for me. I was able to get my driver's license so I can drive around, work permit so I can start applying for jobs. And, you know, I can also start applying for colleges, because when I didn't have that, I heard my friends talking about it. Oh, college this, college that. And I'm just in the background like, oh, yeah, college. But it started opening not a lot of doors, but somewhat of doors, so I can be able to reach my goal.
Simba, what about you?
3 years ago, I was still in undergrad.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to, you know, work hard as a college student and hopefully try and apply to medical school one day. And so now with the DACA program coming to an end, I'm not too sure what's going to happen to that dream.
But you want to be a doctor?
That is my plan, to help our community, especially underserved community here in Georgia. And with the work permit being gone, we're not too sure about how the licensing is going to work, how people are going to be able to continue on working. So it's going to be a struggle.
Marisol?
So when I got DACA, I had this big weight lifted off of my shoulders, because I was the International Baccalaureate program in high school, because my plan was, everyone was demonizing me for being in this country, and I was going to go back to Mexico, and that's why I did the IB program, because everybody said, go back to your country. With the DACA program, it gave me hope. Now, I thought that DACA was a pathway for a green card. I thought it was a pathway to citizenship, and mm-hmm. I was so happy. Come to find out, it was not. Mm-hmm. DACA was temporary. We had to renew every 2 years. We have to pass a criminal background check, and it gave us work authorization. Now that I've lived with DACA, I am determined to keep working towards a permanent solution and staying into this country, because if we leave, we are doing a disservice to the state. Because growing up here and having the state of Georgia allowing us to be here K through 12, it would just minimize the amount of resources that the state has if they sent us anywhere else.
I'll give you the last word.
I completely agree with Marisol has said, and I think that in this moment, it's really important for all of us out here who are undocumented who are DACA recipients to remember that this isn't the end for us. We are here to stay, and it's important for us to continue to stick together, to continue calling our representatives and our senators, and we need to organize our communities and make sure that the people around us understand exactly what kind of a challenge it is to be undocumented, and we will continue to fight until we get to stay right here where we deserve.
Raymond, Sumble, Marisol, and Alondra, thank you all for coming in and sharing your story. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And before we sign off, some breaking news. According to the AP, Paris is awarded the 2024 Olympics, and LA gets the 2028 game. So there's some time. That's it for today's show. Closer Look was produced by Candace Wheeler, Ebony Lemon, and Finley Foxen. Our engineer is Elizabeth Eads. Our executive producer is Christine Dempsey. As always, a special thanks to the entire WAB News team, as well as our digital services crew. You know, if you missed any of today's show, you can find the entire program online at wabe.org/closerlook. And you can always catch Closer Look weeknights at 9 p.m. if you just want to hear me talk again. I'm Rose Scott. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE. Atlanta's choice for NPR.